Welcome. This is the second in a series that Father Greg Carlson of the Society of Jesus and myself, Father Larry Gillick of the Society of Jesus at Creighton University, we are presenting on the topic of the similarities in theme between the fables of Aesop and the parables of Jesus. And today we are going to expand a parable from Luke's Gospel. So if you wish, you could get your Bibles out and go to Luke 15:11.
Larry, it's great to be with you again today. I'm going to start us off with a fable that actually doesn't come from Aesop. It comes from another tradition that grows out of India. The title of the book that it comes from, a famous book through the late Middle Ages up until now, is called Kalila and Dimna. Let me set up where this fable comes. Kalila and Dimna, the book, contains several large stories, and it's really fun because there are fables within fables within fables in this book that we would probably read as kind of a novel. Mm-hmm. The first of these extended stories is played out between two brother jackals. Kalila, a fairly serious, reflective, actually good jackal, and his brother Dimna, who is ambitious. The two of them talk with each other throughout this fable, and what's happening is that Dimna, who's a character much like Iago, wants to be more in influence at the court of the Lion King, and so spends a fair amount of time plotting especially against the Lion King's new friend, Shanziba the Bull. He comes back several times to report to Kalila about what he's feeling, and Kalila's message, which becomes more and more strong, is, Dimna, don't meddle. You're going to hurt yourself, you're going to hurt other people. Dimna doesn't listen. He's ambitious. He wants to destroy his rival, Shanziba, so that he can have more influence at court. And in fact, he succeeds. He destroys the bull. He undermines the confidence that there is between lion and bull. And then Kalila tells him one last story. And that's the story I want to tell you now. Kalila says there were two people who had a good deal to do with each other, and as far as they could tell, they were friends. And both of them were in business, both of these young men. One of them, who was single, wanted to go off and see if he could make money out in the world. Mm-hmm. And so he said to his married friend at home, I want to leave some of my money with you, so that if I come back and have lost all my money, I at least have something here. So I'd like to leave it in trust with you. And this other friend agreed to that. And they agreed that he would leave the money behind as a huge block of iron, valuable metal. The friend at home would keep it in safekeeping until the traveling friend could return. And that would be, if you want, his nest egg for getting back into business when he returned home, if he had nothing else. So the friend went off, and in fact, he actually did all right. He made money, but it was several years before he came back. Now, you need to know that during that time, the friend at home had some good times and some hard times. In one of the hard times, he wondered whether his friend would actually ever come back for his iron, and he sold it off and used the money himself. So the traveling friend comes home, is welcomed by his old friend at home, who has a family now with a couple of kids.
And who misused his money.
He misused this man's money.
Okay.
And in the course of conversation, the traveling friend says, and so I've come back, and though I have some money of my own now, of course, I want to use the money from that iron. So I'm going to have to ask you for my iron block back. And the at-home friend says, "Oh, I have such bad news for you there. Something strange happened. I had it in the cellar and, of course, kept it and protected it for you. And we had a problem with iron-eating mice. They came in and ate up your whole iron block."
Wow.
Now, the traveling friend understood immediately what was up and said, "Oh, again, I've had bad luck with iron-eating mice before, and I'm so sorry to hear that they did it again. But I understand that's the way things happen. We'll have to let it go." Now, the at-home friend who had really stolen was so relieved and amazed and surprised that his friend bought this story of iron-eating mice, that he said, "Well, let's sit down to a dinner together. Let's celebrate that we're back together, that you're home safe." And they had a lovely dinner. It was like old times. As the traveling friend left that evening, he noticed one of his friends or associates' kids playing out in the front yard as he left. And after his friend saw him to the door and closed the door and went back into the house, this traveling friend took with him the 4 or 5 year old child of his friend and quietly took him back home with him.
Kidnapped him.
Kidnapped him. That's what he did. The next morning, as he got up, his friend was pounding on the door and saying, "Have you seen anything of my child? He seems to have disappeared, and I am so distraught." And the traveling friend said to him, "You know, it's a funny thing. As I was walking home last night, I saw an eagle taking off from the land and going up into the air, carrying a child. That must have been your child that was carried off by that eagle."
Wow.
And the at-home friend said, "Come on, I don't believe a story like that. Eagles don't carry off children." And the traveling friend said, "Well, in a town where mice eat iron, I think you can understand that eagles carry off children." Here's what came of the story. Of course, the kidnapping traveling friend returned the child. And of course, the friend at home returned the sum of money he had made on selling the friend's iron block. But the result of this story is that they never exchanged a word with each other again in life. It was the absolute end of their relationship, of their friendship. Now, Kalila, Larry, tells this story to Dimna after he has destroyed the king's best friend out of ambition. And Kalila says with all the anger he can to his jackal brother, "I disown you and I never want to talk to you again." So he's told this story to tell about the destruction of their relationship together. So that's my fable for today. Fable of the mice that ate iron.
Right, but what's so in that fable, that story, what is the human element most vulnerable or most picked on there? Is it the selfishness of the man that killed the bull? Is it selfishness? Is it greed?
The ambition of that jackal that had to remove his friend. The reason I bring this fable today with the parable that we're going to read is the traveling friend in the story that Kalila tells Dimna. Let me take the take-home friend. Missed the relationship that he was entrusted with. He misunderstood it, he misused it, and he destroyed it.
So what is it? The misuse of a relationship will destroy the relationship.
Will destroy the relationship.
And envy or greed and jealousy can do that.
Ambition, yes, those things. Okay. They can do that. And so Kalila tells this story to say to his brother, that's the way it is now between you and me. You have destroyed our relationship by what you have done in destroying the king's best friend.
All right. Good, wonderful. The story that parallels that in a sense, we know it as the prodigal son, which follows, this is in Luke 15, which follows two little parables. One is the lost coin, and the other is the lost sheep. And the shepherd goes and finds the one lost sheep, and the woman who loses the coin sweeps all over and then finds it. Both rejoice at their finding. One interpretation of all three of these parables is that Luke wanted the church community, the relationships, what you were talking about, the relationships within the church to be so sacred that one person straying from the community is worth going after, seeking out, searching all over the house, searching all over, as a shepherd would go after the sheep. It's not just a person who has sinned, but a person who has betrayed the relationship with God within the church and has gone off seeking his or her own deity or her own his own way of living. Well, we see that even more expanded in this parable that does parallel the fable you read. And it is, of course, that it involves being entrusted with some goods. But the goods are as with the iron, is a reflection of the preciousness of the relationship, right?
Exactly.
Okay, so the father has a greater love for his son, and the son has a greater love for the possessions that the father is going to give him as property at his death. Well, he says, I'd like that now. So he goes, the father divides what falls to him, and he leaves, possessing not the relationship with the father or anybody else, but an intense relationship with himself through the medium of the possessions. And of course, as you said, if you destroy or misuse the things of the relationship, you'll destroy the relationship, right?
Yes, right.
Okay, so he misuses the relationship by misusing the father-son relationship, and he squanders both the relationship and the property. And then there's a great line in this parable of Jesus. He says, he comes to his senses, which is a great line because there he is sitting in among the pigs, smelling, feeling the muck and the mud.
Dirt poor,
hungry. He comes to all his senses of the five senses and then comes to his intellectual senses. And he says, I must return. I will go and I will say, this is what I'm going to say. And so he rehearses it and he says it. I will say it. And the interesting thing in the parable is that, of course, like the shepherd and like the woman seeking the coin, the father is seeking him. So there's there's something in the necessity of community to, it's because it's a family, to not give up on the relationship, which is different from your fable.
You bet.
Because they give up on the relationship.
That's it.
And traveler says that's it.
Yes.
So, but the prodigal son returns, and the father is looking for him, and apparently, and this is the fun of the parables and the fables, is that there are interpretations. For instance, is the Father Jesus? Is the Father God? Or is it not consistent with the other two parables, the community, mm-hmm. the family? Mm-hmm. That the family, the church, is seeking the Son, and the Son, but does not force the Son. Now, you know, we have parents who worry about the faith life of their children, and you can't force them to believe in God or go to church or whatever. They've got to come back by themselves. But the church, excuse me, is always meant not only to protect, but to seek out that which was lost. So he goes back, and the Son has to say, this is a beautiful thing about this parable. The Father doesn't need the Son to say anything.
Right.
The Son needs to say it because that's the kind of human beings we are. We need to say, I have something to say to you. We're what we call inside-out people. We do have to say the truth that is within us. It can't be implied. It must be explicitated. It must be sung or written or actually said face-to-face. Because the land is so precious as a blessing. The land was, in biblical times, an exact sign of God's blessing. Mm-hmm. And so he went into a foreign land, and he didn't belong there, and he had squandered the relationship. He comes back, and the relationship of that the community has with those who are lost is the image of God, who is also saying, I can never give up on you. I will always seek for you.
Right.
I will seek for you in the through the community. So it's not just God calling people back, according to this parable, our interpretation of it. But it's the community. But also, you could say, no, that's Jesus who is always looking for me, and I have committed a personal sin, and I have to go back. But the parable, this interpretation is, and that's the beauty of parables, that it's not just one exact meaning.
You bet.
Just like and that's what we're saying here, that the parables and the fables have something in common, that there's many interpretations. So it's God and Jesus seeking out one individual, but it's the community not giving up, whether the community is the family or the larger church. It's that we are always welcoming back those who, by their freedom, have drifted off.
That's very helpful. Laura, I want to say several things in response to that. First, the understanding of the church seems to me to really enrich the understanding that the Father sets the tone for the way the church receives
yes.
people back.
That's right.
That's terrific.
Yeah.
Let me say this is, I think this is one of the best stories ever composed. I teach literature, and I don't know how much of this is Jesus, I don't know how much is Luke, but
yeah.
there is a profound understanding of what it is to be a parent and what it is to be a human being in this story. I would say, let me say, my own interpretation starts by saying the Father here is God. I think this is Jesus' image of God in this story. This mm-hmm. is the Father he prays to.
Yes.
And Jesus seems to me to be so singular in the way he conceives of God through story, or expresses God through story. This is the God he finds to be his loving Father.
Yes.
A couple of things strike me that I wanted to throw out and see how you are with them. One of them is the little detail that the Father sees the Son a long way off.
At a great distance, yes.
For me, that says the Father was looking for the Son. Whatever else this Father was doing around the farm,
mm-hmm.
He had an eye out on the road from the day his Son left, hoping, wanting that the Son would be coming back. So that's the first thing
okay.
I want to say that I find so revealing in here is the Father doesn't need an announcement from anybody that his Son has just showed up at the front gate.
Right.
He has been hoping and longing and wishing for this Son to return. ever since the son walked away.
Which is to say that the relationship on the part of the son was terminated.
Exactly.
Not on the part of the father, not on the part of God. Exactly. So that the question, when I give up on God, does God give up on me, is answered in this parable.
And the answer is never.
Never.
He is always watching for any kind of movement, any kind of sign that you want to come back.
That's right.
So that's where another thing I'd want to say, Larry, is you're right. That son, because he has destroyed the relationship, needs to make his statement to the father.
Right.
But if you're that father, you don't need to interrupt him, but you're going to interrupt him. You hear the first line or two out of this rehearsed speech, and you move in and sort of wave off the rest of the speech.
Right.
You don't need to hear it.
Yes.
You know where the son is going.
Right.
So the father never let the relationship be destroyed. And in that sense, you're right. He is a clear contrast with Kalila, who's saying to Dimna, that's it. I never want to talk to you again in my life. I disown you. I can't stand what you have done here. The father will never say something like that to the son, this father, in Jesus' parable.
No, that's right. What's interesting, too, is that the second story within the story, the traveler and the man who sold the lead, they had to have a party, you know, at the end. And here the father and the son, the returned son, they prepare a party. And it's got to be ritualized.
Yes.
You know, this whole thing has to be not implied. There has to be the human experience of we've got to do something. So, say, in the Catholic Church, there is the saying in reconciliation. We have to say it, but it's done in ritual. It's done in community because it is a return to my homeland.
Yes.
You know, because he comes home. He was in a foreign land and it didn't work. He had squandered everything. There was a famine. There was nothing of a relationship sustaining him. So he comes home. But there's got to be the killing of the fatted calf. There's got to be the ring on the finger and the robe around him, because that which was dead by his choice has come back to life.
Yes.
Now, one of the problems here, and I want to emphasize it before we go on to the next fables, is did the prodigal son, was he moved to go back to his father out of his own sense of who he was? Which is to say, did he do it out of his own grace? Did he make the grace? You see where I'm going?
Yes.
Okay. Or was the prevailing relationship that abided with the son, was that not the grace that initiated the coming to his senses? You know what I'm saying? That, because the question is, do we go to God first, or is God always coming to us, that even our return to God is God's grace to us?
Right. Let me say, I want to come at your question, but I want to take a little detour first. Is
go
that
ahead.
Okay?
Sure.
I want to go back to what you were saying, that the son asks the father for what he would have gotten on the father's death.
Right.
And asks for that now.
Yeah.
A couple of things I've read about what this story would mean in Middle Eastern culture at the time Jesus was telling it, or Luke is putting it into the mouth of Jesus. A couple of things have stuck with me. One of them is what the son is really saying to his father when he asks for his portion of the patrimony is, I would rather you would be dead. I can't wait for you to die.
Uh-huh.
It is a terrible statement for that father to hear. The son could hardly say anything more negative to him. Now, I don't think the son knows he's saying that.
Yeah.
This son is so much in his own world.
That's right.
That he's saying to the father, I wish you were dead. If you went up to that son and said, is it really true you want your father dead? He'd say, oh, no.
No.
It has nothing to do with it. I want to live my life. Give me my stuff and let me go find my way.
Yeah.
He's enclosed in a very self oriented world.
That's right.
And really is unaware of the relationship that's there. He's
right.
But it
remains in the heart of the Father.
It remains in the heart of the Father for sure. So that's my background when I come to your question. What really happened to the son out there with the pigs?
Yeah.
And my sense is that, as in the histories of most of us, the conversion, if you want to call it that,
yes,
of this son,
yeah,
is very mixed.
I mean, mixed of motive?
Mixed motives, left mm-hmm. and right.
Mm-hmm.
What he's saying is, I got a bad deal here.
Yeah.
This is a bad situation. I would do better as a hired hand in my father's place. Well, let me improve myself and go back.
So is he still selfish?
He's still selfish. He's got some sense of the way he offended his father.
Mm-hmm.
But if you were to catch him along that road before he comes over the hill where his father could see him,
mm-hmm.
and were to say, are you really doing this now to restore the relationship with your father, or are you just after a better meal ticket? I'm not sure the son could give a very good answer.
He'd probably answer the way you wanted to hear it.
Yeah, I mean,
but in his heart,
in his heart, I don't know if he has yet really understood his father's love for him.
Right.
Now, so you're asking the question, was it in a sense his father's love that created the possibility for him to come back? Yes. And is it God's love that draws us back rather than us creating our conversion? The answer is yes, it's God that's doing this.
Yes.
What I want to do is, I think Luke and Jesus are very sensitive here to the fact that human conversion is always out of mixed motives.
Messy.
It may be as selfish as it is altruistic.
Uh-huh, that's
it's
very,
messy.
Yeah.
And the problem is the converting person shouldn't be judging himself.
Okay.
His job is to get his body back to his father.
Right. And God says, whatever, apparently, what in this parable,
I'll take whatever you got.
Whatever your motive was for coming back,
I take you back.
I'll take you back because my motive is love.
And in a sense, my arms around you are going to create your motivation better than anything, and it'll make up for anything you can do.
And my welcoming, the Father says, my welcoming you back will be your final conversion, because you will be converted to more love.
Maybe then you will start to understand the way I love you.
The real relationship.
The real relationship. Mm-hmm. But if you don't understand it then maybe the next time
yeah,
around on
yeah.
this, you're going to catch it.
Yeah.
Now, one other thing that I have picked up in reading about this is, the father ran out to the son on the road.
Yes.
And put his arms around him and threw a cloak, you know, said, get the cloak, and put a ring on his finger.
Mm-hmm.
This is part of the ritual you're talking
yes.
about. And some of the function of the ritual here is the father protecting this son from the townspeople, who might well have reacted by stoning this fellow.
Uh-huh.
He has rejected them as much as he's rejected his father
mm-hmm.
and his family.
That's
he walked
right.
away and said, this town isn't good enough for
the
me.
Community. Yeah.
The community.
Mm-hmm.
He destroyed his relationship with the community. And the father is out there not just accepting him back personally, but protecting him. None of those people in the community can raise a hand against this kid once that cloak is put upon him and the rings on his finger, and the father has announced, he's back, he's alive again, I'm so happy. The father, the way Jesus tells that story, the father is doing such a good job of recreating this relationship.
Yeah, that's right.
Himself.
Yeah.
He's taking whatever the son gives him, which mm-hmm. may not be a whole lot more than just stumbling home hungry
that's right.
to get a meal. Does that make
yes,
sense
so,
to you?
Yes, so whatever the motive is, the motive of the father overrides that.
Yes.
And embraces it.
Takes it up and makes more of it,
yeah.
sees more in it, and
right.
and puts more energy
right.
and depth into it.
So that the father, like the Christian community, should never give up on the possibility of recreating those who have been lost.
Right. And Larry, I really like what you say, that this is a pattern for the Christian community to find what's lost. But I'd say it is that, because that's Jesus'
that's
idea
right.
of who
yeah.
God is.
So the community reflects
its
own experience of being found. by God.
Right. Okay. And so the community is not going to immediately put limits and conditions and terms on its sort of willingness to accept people back.
Okay.
It's not going to turn judge.
Yes.
When it has seen a God who's busy to overturn judgment.
That's right. Yeah. Do you have some fables to end this discussion? Do we have a little?
I'm going to tell another one that's a little bit more positive.
Mm-hmm.
And it too is about a father and three sons. So this is a father who, like our fellow in the parable, has been a vineyard owner for many years and has three sons all in their teens. And these three sons have never shown much interest in the father's vineyard. In fact, they've been fairly lazy boys who have mostly squandered their time. The father, who has worked hard on this vineyard, the family-owned vineyard from all sorts of generations, realizes one day that he is coming to his death, and in fact that it's coming quite soon. He knows he has a very short time to live. And so he calls his sons around him on what turns out to be his deathbed. And the sons are, as usual, lazy, unruly, not ready to respond, but they finally understand that this may be the last that they're going to hear from their father. And so the sons gather around the father on his deathbed, and he says, "My sons, there is a treasure in that field of our family. There is treasure buried in that field." And with that, he can't say much more, and he dies.
Oh.
Now, the sons take care of burying their father, as they must, but the first thing they do is get out pitchforks and shovels and tools, and they move through that vineyard, starting at one end and going to the other, day after day, turning over the soil in that vineyard, searching for the treasure that their father said was in that field. After weeks and then months of turning over the ground in that large vineyard that belonged to their family, the sons came to the end of the field, and they never found any buried treasure. But they already started to experience that they had turned over the field so well that the new crop coming up was bigger than anything they had ever experienced before.
Uh-huh.
The new harvest was there because they had turned the soil by their labor and effort. And so the sons realized that the treasure in that field was the family heritage of working the vineyard.
Mm-hmm.
This clever father, died now, had found an inspired way to get at something about relationship with his sons, to give them what he treasured most from his family, the tie to the land that you talked about before. Yeah. It's the same tie to the land. It's our land. And these sons, I suppose it's natural for a lot of us in our young years and our teens, they were just living for themselves and living for whatever fun they could have. They hadn't gotten serious about the father, about the family, about work. And the father, in telling him there was a treasure in the field, found a sort of key to put into their lock that opened up to them not only who he was for them, that he's the one who kept the treasure for them and who finally, in his last words, was able to pass along the treasure to them.
Okay, but he gave them, we're back to the double motive.
Yep.
So just as the prodigal son comes back maybe for an impure motive, the men go out to find the treasure. The boys go out to find the treasure for greed.
And they found more.
They found more than greed could give them.
That's right. And that's the cleverness of this father. He found the motive that would speak to them, that would finally get them to work, to engage themselves. And engaging themselves in that case finally revealed to them what their father was about, what he had given them.
Yeah.
what family was about, what relationship, not just to the land, but to their father was. Well, in a little way, that fable is talking about some of the same things that the prodigal father is getting at, that he's trying to introduce his sons to something of what this relationship might be.
Yeah.
And he has to go through their door, if you want. They thought they could get rich quick by finding something here. He's trying to teach them about the joy of working and seeing the results of your work and inheriting what he had gotten from his father his father had gotten from his grandfather.
And what he had gotten by laboring in that vineyard himself.
That's it.
It's interesting that maybe, that being said, maybe the father in the prodigal son is saying, the only way my son is ever going to know what it is to be a real human being is that I too send him out, in a sense, to discover a treasure, that is, what the real relationship is. That real relationship does not depend on the accumulation of pleasure and property, but in the continuation in community, in relationships.
Yes, and Larry, when I say this is one of the greatest stories ever, I marvel at whether it was Jesus or Luke who can get into this father in the story of the prodigal son and can sense his pain, his joy. It took so much, as I understand that father, it took so much for him to let the son go, to give him his portion of the inheritance and say, go ahead.
It's almost an investment that he made in us.
Yes, trusting, hoping that someday the kid would come back, would come to himself, would come to his family. And really, as I've suggested, those two are very close to each other. Coming to his senses was coming to himself. Dante says, you know, in the middle of my years, I came to myself in the middle of a dark wood. He's just like that son at the Dante at the beginning of the Inferno. But it took so much trust for that father to let the son go, hoping he would get the son back.
That's right.
But he was a good father. I mean, so many of us, if we were that father, would have come out with a string of expletives, disowned the son, said he was not worthy of us, which is probably true. But it's this father lives for that son.
Yeah.
And so he can take the pain of letting him go. That's why I'm hoping we're going to do another session on the second half of this parable.
Yeah.
And I want to see, because I think there again the father shows what a great father he was.
Yes.
And Jesus shows he understands what parenthood is by the way he can get inside that father's pain.
That's beautiful,
with the second song.
It's interesting, as you say, the father dispenses with the word worthy. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. He says, bosh, that's not a word I use. You might say that of yourself. You are, in a sense, more worthy of my love as a gift rather than something earned.
Right.
I give it to you. You will know it more as a gift than that which befell to you because of inheritance.
Right.
It comes to you because I freely give it to you, even in the wretched condition that you think you're in.
Yes, Larry, it's like that one other portion where one of the evangelists quotes Jesus as saying, when you've done all that you can do, you should say, we're unprofitable servants. I think we should take Jesus quite literally there, or the evangelist that's quoting him. It's important for us to say, we've only done what was asked.
Right.
We're unprofitable servants. But I don't think we are ever going to hear that from the God who embraces us. He knows it's important for us to admit how much we need him, how much we're at best just doing what's asked of us. But I don't think he sees us with those eyes. He knows it's good for us to be honest about how small we are. But to him, we're big. We're special. He's going to run out onto that road and put his arms around us and rejoice that we're back.
But never force us, but invite us, if not directly, at least indirectly, by the nature of the relationship. Because the father was not calling to the son in a way that the son could hear him. He called in a way that the son heard him from inside himself because of his memories of his father.
Yep.
Well, very good. The next offering in this series will be In the same chapter, it's the other side, the elder son. Who is the elder son? And Father Carlson will have some more exciting insights from our friend Aesop. Thank you, Greg.
Thanks, Larry. It's a pleasure again.